Hey, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where in the world you are. I am Eric Rubenstein, and I am still the Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse here at Advise Health. And this is another iteration of the OIG Roundtable, and so I am once again joined by my former OIG co-workers and current co-workers, although it's not a round table, it's more of like Hollywood Squares. We've got Matt Kachansky, Jason Eisengrein, and Wade McFall. Of course, you could see that the three of them are in chilly climates. I'm wearing a t-shirt, so I am clearly not in a chilly climate. And, you know, we're going to spend the next half hour talking about not fashion and not our chilly climates. We're going to be talking about testifying at grand juries, testifying in hearings, testifying at trials. And then we're really going to get a little bit of an inside perspective on testifying at congressional hearings, which are slightly different. Matt is actually the one person in the group and probably one of the few people at OIG who had the opportunity to go and testify before Congress. So we're going to talk a little bit about that because that's obviously an interesting thing to glean. That's a little bit different than the normal stuff. So I think it's important for us all to kind of have a little bit of a level set on the fact that testifying in these different environments really is different. When you're testifying in grand jury, it is very different than testifying in trial. It is also very different than testifying at an ALJ hearing, and obviously extraordinarily different from testifying in front of Congress. Most of the time when you're doing testimony, it starts with grand jury. And just for a level set, what grand jury is, it's a one-sided piece of the scales of justice puzzle, meaning that the prosecutor schedules time in the grand jury. The grand jury is comprised of between 17 and 23 people, sorry. So 17 is quorum, max number is 23. And the purpose of the grand jury is to listen to the government's testimony and documents and evidence as it is supporting the prospect of getting an indictment. And an indictment is not anything more than a document that is a probable cause, meaning that there is a reason to believe that something happened, more likely than something didn't happen. But at the end of the day, all of the facts need to be put before a trial, which is either before a judge or a jury. And that is where the ultimate determination of guilt or not guilt, as the case may be. But when we're talking about grand juries, the prosecutor sets the time, the prosecutor schedules the witnesses to come in, and the purpose of witnesses is to provide testimony regarding the facts that are known at the time relative to the crime that is being sought to be charged. Now, the thing that's interesting about grand juries is that in some states, grand jury rules allow for a lawyer from the defense to be present, but not to be able to make any objections or provide any opinions or anything like that. They're just there as a listening post. We're going to focus a lot on federal grand juries, federal trials and the like, where the rules are a little bit different. In a federal grand jury, the grand jurors only get to hear the testimony from the witnesses that the government puts forth. And so they're only hearing one side of the tale. And, you know, grand juries can go on for weeks, they can go on for months, they can go on for years, depending upon how the investigation, you know, is going. So, Wade, I'm going to start with you. You know, as a field agent, you know, you and I were talking about it. We both spent a lot of time in grand jury and a lot of time preparing for grand jury and then testifying in the grand jury. Talk a little bit about kind of generally your experiences in getting ready for grand jury, both personally what you're doing, but then also what are the kinds of things that you're doing when you're meeting with the prosecutor?
Yeah, I think it's really important to kind of go into the preparation that goes into preparing for the grand jury. I mean, you have to know your the evidence that you've generated throughout your investigation. You're basically going to review all that and expose it to the jurors, as you said. One thing about the grand jury that is, I guess I would say, a lot easier than like a trial situation is you have typically the AUSA who's going to be asking you the questions, but you can really practice it and go over it and rehearse it. So there shouldn't really be any surprises. You know exactly what the prosecutor is going to ask you. You should have already discussed what the answer will be. So you will be well enough prepared that you can answer all those questions. If it's something that you don't remember or you don't really have the answer to, you can just say, I don't know. You don't want to start making things up, but the more you say, I don't know, the more it looks like you're not really prepared. But again, you will have gone over all these questions with the prosecutor ahead of time. And if it's a good prosecutor, they're really, they can really walk you through. They can lead you with the right questions to get you to the answers that they're looking for. You know, they have their notes and written down questions and you're kind of off the fly, but if they are experienced, they're going to ask the questions in such a way to kind of spark your memory. And you can always say, you know, you need to refresh your recollection, but it's really a back and forth conversation really between the prosecutor and yourself. And then of course there's an opportunity for grand jurors to ask questions at the end of your testimony.
Now, so the one thing that you brought up is, you know, kind of this concept of that they're asking you questions for which you've practiced and you have the answers. And I think it's important for people that are tuning into this podcast to understand that this isn't the creation of a fact or the creation of a responsive line to questions. It's really the point of this is presenting a set of facts that are known that are typically in conjunction with a set of documents that are presented to the grand jury that are telling the story about why the government believes that the individual under investigation should be charged with the particular crime, that it's not the creation of facts, it's not the creation of evidence, it's not, you know, anything that is, you know, sort of based out of TV. There's nothing explosive that gets brought out in a grand jury.
Yeah, and you would have already gone through the evidence that you feel you need to get in front of the grand jury in order for them to vote for indicting the subject. So you want to make sure that you get all your facts out there that you need in order to persuade the jury to indict. And again, that's as a result of practice and rehearsing. And it's kind of a dog and pony show that it's like a conversation or an interview of you as the person testifying. But like you said, there's no surprises. We've gone over this. We know what is going to be asked and what is going to be answered to arrive at our evidence that we're trying to get on the record.
And with that being said, my experience in the grand jury has been that it's not, I'm not overly nervous. I'm not really worried about messing it up because it's kind of a straightforward process. So I've always found, we were talking about this before, you know, I've had 9 trials and the level of stress that testifying in a trial presents is way different than the level of stress in grand jury. Did you find that you were fairly calm and you weren't really very nervous about preparing?
Yeah, especially because of all the preparation that you've done. It's like, again, there's really no surprises. You know what's going to be asked and you know what your answers are going to be. And frankly, even if you kind of fumble on the answers, again, if you have a good prosecutor, they can back you up and re-ask the question in another way to kind of spur your memory if you're kind of getting in the weeds and you don't have all the facts down. Or again, you can have them show you a document to refresh your recollection if you forget about the total loss amount or some numbers that are, again, kind of in the weeds. They can show you a document to refresh your recollection. So there's really no surprises, and it's not that stressful. Like you're talking about trials. I haven't really done trials. I've done just enough to like introduce a piece of evidence, but I haven't really experienced the cross-examination that some others have that can be a nightmare.
The other thing about grand juries is, you know, the goal is to get the suspect charged with specific crimes. Those crimes have elements that have to be met legally. And it's our job as the witness to the grand juries to present the evidence that meets those elements of the law so that the grand jury can then decide on, you know, on indicting or not just based on the evidence that's been presented to them.
Right. Which is really why it's this one-sided you know, this one-sided piece of the puzzle. So, you know, one of the things that I learned, and I, you know, like all of us, we've testified, you know, countless number of times in grand jury. A lot of times the agent that testifies in the grand jury isn't even the agent that was the case agent, right? And oftentimes that's the case because they don't want to create a record by the case agent. You know, it's a little bit of a legal strategy. You know, I found in for me, the biggest difference is in testifying in trials, the stress level could be through the roof. And I think that as you get better at doing it and you get more trials and you do more testimony, you know, that nervousness kind of abates a little bit. But the number one thing for me in trials had always been the amount of anxiety that kind of becomes the buildup because, you know, again, in a grand jury, you know what the questions are, you know what the answers are. In a trial, when you're on the stand as the government's witness and the prosecutor calls you, you've done that prep similar to what you did in the grand jury. The difference is you only know a portion of the questions and then therefore a portion of what your answers are going to be. When you're on that cross-examination from the defense, you have no idea what they're asking. A lot of those questions are compound questions, they're complex questions. You know, the reality is that in a lot of these situations, I think the goal of a defense attorney is to get the witness to say no to as many things as they can get a witness to say no to the things that they would want them to say no to about what they know or don't know, because that's the thing that's going to help put some doubt in. You know, one of my last trials I had, the defense had put on their case. It was a kickback case. The defense had put on their case. I did not testify on behalf of the government. Another agent did. And just as the defense was getting ready to rest its case, they called me as a witness, which is something that the defense rarely will do, is call the government's agent as their own witness. I've seen that twice in two trials I had. One, I was called as a witness. And in another trial I had towards the end of my career, my co-case agent from the FBI was called as a witness by the defense. And it didn't go well either way, you know, either time. You know, even though given that we didn't know the answers to the questions that we were being asked, you know, as the case agent, you should have absolute command of the facts of the case. And so, you know, it becomes a little bit of a challenge to remain calm and kind of have that flat effect. So, Jason, I want to go to you because, you know, when I first started as an agent, it was right after you had concluded a trial involving the Jackson brothers. And I had just gotten hired as an agent. You had just finished the trial. I didn't get to see the trial, but it was a victorious result. And so, you know, and you had spent a number of years in kind of like Matt, the early days, right? You were hired at the, you know, the late 80s, sort of early 90s when resources were being put into healthcare fraud investigations and prosecutions. And it was really at a time where prosecutors were even more naive than they sometimes can be today. What, you know, looking back historically, what did you see as some of the, I don't want to use trials and tribulations, but some of the trials and tribulations of having to prepare for a trial in which the prosecutors, as good as they may have been, still weren't to the level that prosecutors are today?
Well, first I would say that there is a reason why trial is named a trial. I mean, it truly is an experience of complete examination of what it is that you did. So to the points that have already been made, the preparation for the trial starts at the first interview, maybe even before the first interview of a witness. I can, you know, anecdotally, I can recall where a co-case agent, an FBI co-case agent, in the interview report, a 302 as it's known, put down that, and specific to those two defendants, the Jackson brothers, it put down that after pushing the Rodney Jackson several times, and whatever came as a result of it, the defense counsel really just wanted to focus on about pushing, and about, you know, what does that entail? Did it entail physical interaction and things of that nature. So, you know, when you're writing, you have to think about the fact that at some point you're going to probably be examined on what it is you're writing. So even something that's fairly benign, as at least I thought that was, it became a good 15-minute cross-examination of, you know, why would you, you know, have to push someone and things of that nature. The second thing is that I would suggest that you think about what type of exhibits would be helpful. As you're suggesting, Eric, especially in those earlier days, there were probably prosecutors with less experience in terms of presenting this information to the jury. And you might have had several good experiences. So whether it's a map, whether it's a financial analysis of a situation, a link analysis chart of all the people that were involved in a conspiracy, if that's the issue, could be very helpful. And, finally, I'll just say that you can't stress enough, I know it's already been said, but preparing and knowing your information is really important. And don't be afraid to say you don't know when you don't know. Again, an anecdote that I can think of is that many times when the trial is about something that's pretty direct, right? Like a patient received a billing and never received a service. And, you know, there's a pattern of that, and it might look really clear. So what happens is the defense strategy might be to put the program, or in the case of commercial insurance, the company as the problem, and start to talk about, you know, the ineptitude of the process. Well, isn't it a fact that, you know, items could be just miscoded or whatever it is? And it's, you know, they're going to want to, the defense counsel might want to use you as a fact witness to try to disparage the program or the company or, you know, something of that nature. So, you know, it'll be frustrating. Don't let your frustration get the best of you. And don't be afraid to say, well, that isn't my area of expertise, and move on.
Yeah, I think, you know, the important takeaway from what you just said is, you know, not getting frustrated. It's staying the course. It's kind of keeping that flat affect, having patience. You know, the biggest thing I think in any testimony, whether it be an ALJ, an arbitration, a trial, is listening to the question that's being posed, taking that pause to make sure that you understand the question. And also that pause is to give your lawyer an opportunity to provide an objection. And obviously objections are, you know, in grand jury, there are no objections. In ALJ hearings and arbitrations, there are objections that are heard because there's an arbitrator there. But, you know, in depositions, for example, which to me are probably the most painful, this year, I think I've had 6 or 5 depositions, and they are painful. They're long, and they are nitpicky. And the most difficult part for me has been that when a question is posed in which the lawyer wants to object, they can only object and say object to whatever it is, foundation, form. There's no arbiter to determine whether or not the objection is going to be overruled or not. So even though there's an objection, you still have to answer the question. But I think it is important to understand staying the course and keeping that kind of flat affect. And so, you know, I want to turn over to you, Matt, for the last little bit, you know, because you are the one guy in the group that had the unique experience of testifying before Congress. I'm sure it wasn't the full House. I'm sure it was just a subcommittee. And that's a whole different world, right? Because you're going through, there's a topic that you've been asked to come in and testify about as a representative of the organization. And so you've got a prepared statement and then questions. So for the last little bit, take us through how testifying in front of something that to me would be the most stressful. And honestly, you know, I know you're only about 35 years old, so it clearly aged you.
Yes, that's right. To start with, it had nothing to do with healthcare. It was child support and our efforts in enforcing the Child Support Recovery Act. And what has to be remembered is there's an agenda in place. You know, you've got two sides of Congress, the parties. Each of them have an agenda that they want to hit upon during that hearing. So the majority committee, you know, they set the official agenda and they invite the witnesses, and then the minority are there to ask, you know, the cross-examination question. So in that, it's similar to a trial. To prepare for that, you know, we worked with our Office of Congressional Affairs, you know, putting together written testimony, which can be as long as you want, then an oral statement that is made, which is, you know, set by the parameters of the meeting, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, and however long the committee gives you to speak to your, you know, a position paper that you write. And then each of the congressmen or senators has, you know, X number of minutes to ask you questions. And they go back and forth between the two parties asking questions, you know, usually the majority that invited you, you know, in support of your position and asking for more information on that. And then the minority party asking just the opposite, you know, what is wrong with all of this? Why are you doing this? Why are you going after these poor, you know, fathers that can't afford to pay the child support, whatever it may have been. And it's this constant back and forth. So it's, and depending on how many members are there, how many of their aides are there writing questions for them, you know, you could go through a dozen different direct examinations and cross examinations as part of the one hearing. And on top of that, you're usually part of a panel. So there's three or four people there that are, you know, going through the same thing, sometimes in rotation, sometimes all at once, where the questions are saved for the end. So it's a lot of preparation. You've got to try to anticipate what the political angles are for each of the congressmen, and then have to, you know, be respectful. And sometimes they're not, you know, as well prepared as you are, and some of the questions are completely from left field, but you try to answer them as best you can.
Yeah, and you know, I think the takeaway is that outside of grand jury, in a deposition, in a trial, in a congressional hearing, you've got this, because it's adversarial in nature, there's going to be a bit of an acrimonious relationship between the two parties. You know, us as witnesses are just there to present what facts we know and our understanding of the facts and our interpretation of the facts and things of that sort. You know, we're not there making legal conclusions or opinions about things. But, you know, the challenge, I think, is that people are back and forth having their own pissing contest, and you're just cannon fodder for that. And that, I think, that adds to the stress. It adds to the drama. You know, I recently had a deposition over Zoom, which is a challenge in itself. But the lawyer on the other side, to try to get me riled up, at one point took his glasses off and threw them at the computer screen as if that's going to, you know, so, you know, it's hard not to laugh at something like that. It's stressful enough, but then to add in sort of the drama, you know, there's no jury to pander to or anything like that. So, I mean, I think, you know, I think we'd all agree the big takeaways are that having that flat affect is kind of an important piece. You're just there to tell the facts. It's not about bringing in the emotional part. You know, when you're asked about, what do you think about this? Or what do you think about that? It's, you know, I don't really have a thought. It's, this is what the facts are. And I think that people get a little bit more nervous about testifying than at the end, after you've done it a few times, then it's really artificial, right? It's a little bit of it is artificial stress. There's the stress that you're going to suffer from just having to do it. But, you know, we get one of the things that's prompted us to want to talk about this today and sort of our different experiences between grand jury, trial, and the congressional piece is we get a lot of people that ask us about training and education on this. A lot of our clinical coders that do testifying, you know, as you all know, we have two people here that have extensive experience testifying up through the trial level on clinical coding and documentation and CMS's opinion and plan opinions. And it really is a little bit of art, a little bit of science. A lot of it is just being prepared and trained and educated on these things. So, Jason, I'm going to turn it back over to you for some final thoughts. What do you think are some of the key takeaways for being being prepared for testimony, whether it be grand jury, whether it be trial? What are sort of the couple, three things that are the most important things for you?
First, I would just want to reflect that when, especially in congressional hearings, while I hadn't been the witness, I sat behind the person being a witness and being kind of their subject matter expert, if you will. And I felt like the witness was in a tennis match and playing the part of the ball.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and it's not completely unlike, you know, a trial for that matter. But the best I can say for all of it is to go in, to be truthful, obviously, but to be factual, to know your material inside and out, and start thinking about the trial, as I said, on basically day one, because the first time that you meet with the prosecutor, that's what they're thinking about, is how am I going to prove this? Like, as Matt said earlier, about being able to address the elements of that. So, you know, understand the charge that you're expecting to get, and then the relevant pieces of evidence that you've collected that would support those elements.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think, you know, anybody who's working in a position where anything that they do could lead to testimony, people that are doing clinical documentation work, you know, people appeal denials and it could go to a hearing. I think you always have to think in terms of the things that you do today are going to come up later in something. The things that you write down in a memo, in a note, emails, you know, I had a prosecutor who would always say emails are the one time when it's people's unguarded thoughts. We want those emails, right? And that's the truth, right? People tend to not think that emails and texts aren't recoverable. So, you know, great information as always, guys. I really appreciate listening to your different insights. You know, we come from four different perspectives, but interestingly enough, we seem to all kind of always think about the same things in the same way. I don't know if it's that because we were indoctrinated early on at OIG to think that way, or, you know, I think more than anything, people that did our job for a living all have a similar mindset. So, you know, it's important that for people that aren't doing this job but are working in these positions where they may have the prospect of testifying, that they develop that mindset also. You know, here at Advise, we're going to be putting together a training program in calendar 2023. A couple 3-day training program on testifying, talk about some of the nuances of testifying in the grand jury a little bit more, testimony at trial, at hearings and the like. We're going to put together a team of people to help produce that training, to put it together, because it really is amazing how many people have an interest in doing it, but just don't know where to go to get it done. So we're going to be working on that. As always, I appreciate spending the time with you guys. I appreciate the people that tune in. If you are interested in getting our newsletter, please again, hello@advizehealth.com. Our YouTube channel has all of our podcasts, our OIG Roundtable, my Retro Fraud podcasts, and our OIG Files podcasts, as well as some other things. Also, just letting you guys all know, next week we're having a special guest on the OIG Roundtable. More to come on that. It's a person that everybody in the fraud, waste, abuse space knows, a well-known quantity within CMS, now retired. We're going to spend a lot of time talking to this person about their 40-plus years of experience from the CMS side in fraud, waste, and abuse, and what they're continuing to do in retirement to help the Medicare population understand that what those vulnerabilities are. So that's a little teaser. You know, sometimes they call that clickbait, but we're actually going to do something that's legitimate on that next week. So as always, thanks again. I appreciate the time that everybody spends, and we'll see you next time on our podcast.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Thanks.